Saloon. Hollywood Saloon.
You know his name, you know his number, and you know what he does best.
No more foreplay.
United Artists brings you James Bond.
James, you're incorrigible.
One rises to meet a challenge.
GoldenEye, rated PG-13.
It has been a six-year and four-month gap since the last James Bond film. And, you know, if it's going to be that long, you might as well reboot the whole damn thing and bring in someone new, right? New James Bond.
It was time.
Clean the palette, clean the slate.
Well, and not only was it time to bring in a new James Bond, it was time to bring in some outside talent for the broccoli mold.
Right.
They needed to up the ante of their filmmaking, because films had changed a lot since License to Kill. I mean, I'm specifically thinking of Die Hard and how the action picture had grown since Bond. Mm-hmm. Where it used to be Bond was the big action movie game in town. Now he wasn't so much anymore.
Right.
And there were other filmmakers a la James Cameron and John McTiernan who could do, you know, a film on a bigger and better scale than Bond and have sort of a different kinetic way of shooting action than, per se, John Glenn was doing.
Well, think about a movie like True Lies. That's basically a Bond film, just without mm-hmm. Bond.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, everyone's biting the Bond style. So I think, obviously, they knew that they had to go get something. Well,
they needed a stronger action director.
Right.
And I think they found it in Martin Campbell, of all places. I mean,
right.
No Escape, right?
No Escape, Criminal Law, if you remember that.
I remember that. That's the Oldman Kevin Bacon movie, right?
Right. But isn't that strange? I mean, why would you look at his resume and think, okay, that's the guy to do Bond. That's the guy to reboot our series. I think that's a very interesting choice that they would do that. I'm certainly glad they did because, you know, my opinion, I think GoldenEye is fantastic.
If you think about it, what those two movies tell me is, one, he can handle action and location shooting,
right,
and make a movie look bigger than, per se, that it necessarily is. And on the criminal law side, he can work with actors,
right,
and handle drama and perhaps, you know, elicit good performances out of the talent. That's kind of the package you want for an action director,
right,
anyway. You want him to be able to handle both chores with equal skill. GoldenEye is. I think it's a great Bond movie, and it's certainly going to be the best one we see in the Brosnan run. I guess I'm spoiling that right out the bat, but that's just kind of how I feel.
Yeah.
I think it had the most interesting storyline, having it be a colleague.
Alec Trevelyan.
Ready to save the world again?
Right. What 00 was he?
006.
After you, 006.
Six, right. So he's before Bond.
Yep.
Yeah.
Sean Bean.
Yeah.
And a classic henchman, Xenia Onatopp.
Onatopp?
Onatopp.
Oh, yeah.
Man.
You know, it's great to see the woman henchman come back since, you know, May Day and just actually be really good.
Well, Famke Janssen, is she related to you? Janssen?
My family does spell it like that overseas.
Oh, really? So she's a crazy, crazy cousin or something.
Could be.
Yeah, but she was so stinking hot in this movie. I mean, she was crazy as a loon, man. She was nuts. You know, who would ever think that, you know, you could crush somebody with your thighs, you know?
Senya, I can't breathe!
Well, getting it on with him, but she did. But she was like, she was a different kind of Bond chick. You know, she wasn't like classy, sexy. She was like just slutty, dirty, sexy.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm dangerous, sexy.
Yeah, and so I'm like, ba-ding, yes, I'll take that, thank you.
Yes!
Well, I think right from the get-go, it's got a good pre-credit sequence. The bungee jump specifically, I think, is really a lot of fun to watch.
Well, I would call that possibly even one of the best Bond stunts of all, because it's completely real, 100%, you know.
And you know it when you see it, you feel it, and yeah. You know, there's that gasp when the audience sees it. A great opening song, you know, Bono and the Edge and Tina Turner. I mean, that's a great, great combo. Danny Kleiman's first opening credit sequence.
Right.
And it's fantastic with the...
Not to throw Maurice Bender under the bus, because he's a brilliant master. And Daniel Kleiman's obviously building off of everything that he's done.
Well, Maurice Bender's an artist. I mean, right. Danny Kleiman's just a different type of artist.
But I'm telling you, that GoldenEye opening credit sequence is my favorite, flat out. It's absolutely amazing. I love it.
Yeah.
You know, with all the Russian statues and the gun coming out of the mouth. I mean, the visuals are just absolutely, they're so weird and out there, but just fantastic. And, you know, and it's more computer graphics heavy this time.
Oh, sure. I mean, more modern. I mean, it's this is Bond in the mid-90s. It's not the last Bond you saw. And, I mean, I think the film scores points right away by having the 64 Aston Martin in the first scene when Bond's driving it around.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to win the heart of an old Bond fan, that's a good way to do it.
Right.
And I like that he was getting evaluated on the mission, you know, for his skills as a 00, which was always good. I think the inclusion of the first female M was a stroke of really creative inspiration.
Good evening, 007.
Good evening, M.
Judi Dench just nails it, and I like her relationship with Brosnan in the film.
That's one of my favorite things. I love that antagonism that they've got going on.
You don't like me, Bond. You don't like my methods. You think I'm an accountant, a bean counter, more interested in my numbers and your instincts.
The thought had occurred to me.
Good. Because I think you're a sexist, misogynist dinosaur, a relic of the Cold War.
You know, she's like, you're a dinosaur.
Predecessor kept a bottle in the cabinet, you know,
yeah.
And all that. But, you know, it's good, and I think it's not an outlandish storyline. You kind of get the fingerprints of the megalomaniac.
Right.
But Alex Trevelyan, actually, his scheme isn't so outlandish. In fact, it's probably a very real scare in terms of that EMP technology, wiping out electronics.
Right.
And, you know, resetting things and so forth.
Yeah.
You know, the other Bond girl... Isabella Scorpio.
She was not bad either, man.
Not bad at all.
Gorgeous.
And not a typical Bond girl either. She's smart, she's resourceful, and she's actually needed.
Right.
In the overall scheme of things, right. So that was good.
We have a new Moneypenny also.
Right. And I do like this Moneypenny, Samantha Bond.
Yeah.
You know, this sort of behavior could qualify as sexual harassment.
Really? What's the penalty for that?
Someday you have to make good on your innuendos.
I think since Lois Maxwell, she nailed it. Maybe it's just the chemistry between her and Brosnan that works.
Mm-hmm.
But I think she really grew nicely into that role.
Yeah.
I mean, overall, I think it was a very successful reboot. I think it introduced Bond to a whole other new generation while continuing the series.
Well, and I think that Brosnan really got the swagger down.
Name's Bond. James Bond.
He's a real good mixture, somewhere in between Connery and Moore, I think, because he was a little bit more of a brawler than Moore was, you know, because Moore was the gentleman spy. But at the same time, he still, you know, wore his tuxedo very well, was very prim and proper, but he was a little more rough around the edges. You know, he'd kick your ass.
He had a little bit more of a Moore side than a Connery side, but he still had a little Connery.
Connery, right.
At least that side. And, I mean, Brosnan's really, I don't think he gets enough credit sometimes. It's just his physicality as an actor.
Yeah.
Watch the way he walks. He always has a very specific walk for his characters. And it's great to see. I mean, he strides really well. And I know there's one scene in there where he's just sort of like leaning up back and he's dealing with a bomb and like a gun goes off and he does this like little head nod.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's ever so slight, but I just get the feeling he's thinking in character.
Right.
It's a very Bond reaction, and I just love it. I always see him thinking in character, no matter what he's doing on the screen.
Yeah,
it seems appropriate to Bond's reaction, and so I was very much in favor of his portrayal. I liked him. He seemed to be about the right age for it.
Right.
Which made me think he'd have been way too young if he'd have done Living Daylights.
Right, was where they tried to offer him the role, exactly.
Right. I mean, I think the seasoning of the few years worked well for him. And ultimately, a successful Bond movie. I think it's right up there in terms of at least the ones you would want to recommend for people.
Oh yeah,
to see.
I would easily put it in my top 10. I think it's fantastic. A couple things wanted to mention. It's the first James Bond to use computer graphics in the gun barrel opening. Remember, it pans across and you see these kind of shadows going inside of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty cool. I enjoyed that. Kind of modernized it a little bit. That bungee jump was the highest bungee jump from a structure in a film. The drop was over 722 feet.
Wow.
So, you know, almost, you know.
And they got it on film. That's great.
Exactly. So, you know, that's the thing that I wish they would have continued. You know, I mean, that is the classic Bond, the stunts. You get rid of those stunts and don't make them real, you know, you didn't get into trouble. But I'm jumping the gun. We'll talk about that again when we get to Die Another Day. But let's see. If you noticed, well, and you know who your favorite guy is, right? Robbie Coltrane.
Shaken, but not disturbed.
Oh, yeah, yeah, he's in there.
Yeah, Robbie Coltrane.
Because Minnie Driver makes a cameo singing.
Yeah, so Minnie Driver's back there screeching.
Stand by your mom.
In the background, but, you know, you got your Bond, James Bond.
Yeah, and that is funny. He's got a good character.
Yeah. So that was good to see. He'd be a recurring character, as would Joe Don Baker, who was in the Let's Replace Felix lighter mode with Jack Wade.
For crying out loud, another stiff-ass Brit. Your secret codes and your passwords.
And, you know, anything's better than Sanchez.
Sanchez!
And it's also probably the first time that an actor has come back as a completely different character in a major role.
Right.
I mean, he went from being a villain to, you know, CIA operative.
Right.
And I guess he is good friends with the family, so it helps to have those connections.
Yeah, definitely.
But he's good. I think he's a lot of fun in the role.
Oh, no, I liked him, and I liked seeing him back, and I think that was a role that could have continued into the other films. Instead, they tried to bring in, well, we'll get there later, Michael Madsen. God. We'll get there. Anyways, like I said, I think the thing that stands out for me the most, it's just a great film all the way through. It's very believable. Sure, there's gadgets, but it's not just over-the-top stupidity.
Right.
And, you know, with a strong henchman and on a top, great Bond name, by the way, it all came together. And, you know,
I think one of the only weak links is probably the musical score.
Right.
It's a good score. Eric Serra has nothing, you know, to be ashamed about. I think it's a respectable score.
Yeah.
But it's got nowhere near the power, the punch, the romanticism, and just the overall vibe and feel that David Arnold was able to bring to the series. And I truly feel he is the successor to John Barry with the series.
Definitely.
More so than any other composer that has taken on Bond.
Yeah. Well, if we're going to look at what we our chart from before, GoldenEye was budgeted at $60 million. Gross $353 million, so you know, worldwide that ain't bad.
That's a hit.
But our admissions were at $81.2 million, which on the ranking chart of all 20 Bond films, that puts us at number 8. So absolutely not bad at all. And it really was a great relaunch of the series. And the only other thing, the saddest thing about GoldenEye was that it was the final Bond film that Broccoli viewed, Albert Broccoli.
Oh,
so
yeah,
Cubby died, and but at least, if you have to say, you know, he went out on a good film. That was the one
he
to go out.
He did go out on a good one, one he could be proud of. And I think one also good bit of trivia, that the name GoldenEye was the retreat Ian Fleming went off to write the James Bond novels.
Right.
So they at least found a way to work that in as an official title.
Definitely.
Because they had run out of titles. So
yeah.
In GoldenEye, you know, it works in terms of the device they named it and everything.
Exactly.
So.
Oh, grow up, 007.
Yesterday is a memory. Today is history. Tomorrow is in the hands of one man.
Bond. You know the rest.
Tomorrow Never Dies. Now shooting around the world.
Tomorrow Never Dies. Brosnan number 2.
Opening up on the same day as Titanic.
Wow.
It came in as number 2, just a few million underneath Titanic.
But really, I mean, how do you relate to this film? I think that, you know, as any Bond film, it had a great opening sequence that we've come to expect and enjoy. But, I mean, really, this film turned into a Roger Moore film.
Well, I think that it was okay.
Yeah.
We did the hard part. We relaunched Bond, okay?
Right.
Everyone loves Pierce. Everyone loved GoldenEye. Mm-hmm. It's one of our highest grossing Bonds. It did fantastic worldwide.
Right.
What do we do next? Which direction do we go now? Well, we got to do something bigger. We got to amp up the action. And I think, you know, we want to play more to, you know, some of the other strengths. And I'm sure Brosnan wanted to go in more dramatic directions that I don't think the producers were particularly interested in doing. They wanted a streamlined, fun Bond action movie.
Right.
And they probably wanted one somewhat of a more simpler, streamlined plot. And, you know, I think it's right out of the Spy Who Loved Me playbook.
Kind of a strange choice. Yeah, Roger Spottiswoode. I mean, he's done some action movies, Shoot to Kill. Mm-hmm. But he also did, you know, Turner and Hooch, Air America, and best of all, Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. So
I think he did a fine job with it. It's well shot and well put together.
Yeah.
In terms of the script that he was given, I mean, like you said, I think that whole opening scene when he takes the jet, it's right. All really well done.
Sure.
I'm not a fan of the Sheryl Crow singing of the song.
No, terrible.
Maybe if someone else would have sang it.
Yeah, I don't think the song is bad per se, but you know, Sheryl Crow just is screeching on it. And
I just don't think she has the pipes. I'd rather get someone like Christina Aguilera singing it. I mean, someone that can really sing.
Yeah.
And really give it a dynamic.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if she does a Bond song someday.
That wouldn't shock me.
And, you know, I think the idea behind the whole stealth thing and, you know, really trying to play the countries against each other, it's kind of an interesting little plot. But, mm-hmm. Jonathan Pryce, and this is a directorial change. I mean, he could have played that character anyway. He's a brilliant actor.
Right.
But he, I mean, they went all the Broadway.
I want full newspaper coverage. I want magazine stories. I want books. I want films. I want TV. I want radio. I want us on the air 24 hours a day. This is our moment. And a billion people around this planet will watch it, hear it, and read about it from the Carver Media Group. There's no news like bad news.
Well, it was ridiculous. He was so over the top. And it was just, you know, hollering and screaming and I'm going to rule the world.
Just a lot of tapping of that pad. I just know it was like tap, 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 tap.
I know. It was like the guy was insane. It just, it went over the bounds into cartoon comic book silliness.
And so did the henchmen in a way.
Oh, the dumbest, one of the dumbest henchmen, Stamper.
Stamper the Bridge.
Stamper.
Yeah. Well, and this is one of my big bitches about the end of this movie. And I did enjoy seeing Michelle Yeoh in there. You know, she got a little.
I think it was a good stroke of casting. Yeah. I mean, getting a little international flavor.
I sometimes work with a decadent agent of a corrupt Western power.
They say communists don't know how to have fun.
Always fun to see, you know, Bond having to go up against someone who's his equal and having to work right. with them. She more than held her own and I think brought a nice dynamic to the film.
Well, there were some good fight scenes. It's like, if you're going to get her in there, you better put her in some good fight scenes. And that was okay. And the motorcycle scene was kind of fun, even though it was, you know, pretty over the top. But
I really felt like it played its hand with the car scene. I mean, that's my favorite scene in the movie, was the remote control car.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, there's just sort of a... I get the same sort of boyish glee that Brosnan's Bond gets, like when the tires go flat and they raise back up or, you know, refill with air.
Yeah, yeah.
He's got that grin on his face.
Yeah.
That's how I am during that whole sequence. I just think it's a great bit of fun.
No, that sequence is outstanding. Well, then, I mean, that's the deal, is that this film had a lot of good promise in the beginning. It's like you get the opening, you get everything set up and ready to go.
You don't mind when the guy fires the missile and it goes through the back window on this one, right? Because it's not like some 18-wheeler going up on its wheels.
Yeah, it's not. It's like, it's a little unbelievable, but it's not totally ridiculous.
Right.
it might happen, you know? So that scene was outstanding. And so, you know, the first half of this film, you're thinking, wow, this is great. And then it just jumps off the edge into stupidity by the time they get to the stealth ship.
Yeah.
And, you know, and this is what I was going to say at the end. It's like, you know, the tradition of the enemy getting, you know, the gun on Bond and then talking. And Elliot Carver at the end gets the gun on Bond and he starts freaking talking about his plan again.
In a matter of minutes, my plan will succeed. And thanks largely to your efforts, the British Navy will destroy the evidence. And I'll be out of here in a Carver news helicopter covering the event. It's going to be a fantastic show.
It's like, shoot him. Shoot him in the head the second you get the gun. Pop. You know, and even the henchmen did that. It's like everything's breaking apart. Everything's, you know, the stealth ship is destroying and imploding and sinking and all this stuff. And the henchman's chasing Wei Lin over there. And he gets a gun up on her. And does he shoot her? No. He tries to take her back to Elliot Carver.
It's like, so
at that
stupid.
Point, well, at that point, there's nothing to lose. You're only killing her out of revenge for screwing up your plan, you know. But no, we're gonna take her back. Because, like, you know, 5 minutes later, you know, when they were across the room from each other, he was trying to blow her head off. You know,
I know.
Pow, pow, pow.
It's a make up your mind. You want her dead or not?
Yeah, you want her dead or not? So it's just, it's like that is so tired and so played out now, and I was so happy that, you know, we'll talk about this later, that in the new Bond movie that, you know, when they're up on that crane, that guy's like pulling that trigger, pop, 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 you know, and it was empty.
Yeah, you know? I would much rather the gun just be empty and they at least make an attempt.
There was no, you know, now I've got you, Mr. Bond.
I owe you an unpleasant death, Mr. Bond.
And I know that's happened before, but it's like, look, you guys have made, you know, 18 Bond films now. Stop. You know, learn a lesson that this is over the top and stupid. And I think that's what crashes this film, is that, you know, it has all these amazing set pieces in the beginning, but by the time we get to the end, and it really has nothing to do with Brosnan, it's just the story goes, you know, haywire and just shoots down the tubes.
Now, I think Brosnan came ready to play. I certainly do.
Yeah.
And I think the idea of a relationship of a past love or someone that got to him.
Terry Hatcher.
I mean, it's interesting, but it's like we're only getting the Cliff Notes version.
Right.
Specifically thinking about how well it's handled in Casino Royale.
Right.
To get Bond to that emotional state that Brosnan so desperately wants to get him to.
Yeah.
And the script is not really helping, and the film is not really helping, but I mean, I think he's certainly capable, and there's just nice moments, like when he's pouring himself the drink, waiting for her to show up. You know, Brosnan has to do it all, because the script's not going to specifically do it for him.
All right.
But, you know, there's nice moments in there, and I mean, I love the moment where he's off at Oxford, and he's got, like, the Aston Martin parked outside, mm-hmm. and Moneypenny's tracking him down, and...
You always were a cunning linguist, James.
When she hangs up the phone, Imp is staring at her. She goes like...
Don't ask. Don't tell.
Don't ask. And Imp says, don't tell.
Yeah.
Just a great moment, you know? Just yeah. That's good writing. You know, it completely works. But I think this movie is going to be indicative of the trend for the next three. And this is just me, but I think they all start out strong for about 45 minutes to about an hour.
Right.
Where they're really solid and good and they're involving and you're into it. And then the last hour, they just fall right off.
Yeah.
And they get silly and they get ridiculous, and more so as the films go on. I mean, I think it gets worse in the next one and then just absolutely pitiful.
Yeah.
By Die Another Day. So yeah. It's an unfortunate thing, because I think you're right. It's not Brosnan. I think he is the right man for the job at the right time. But I don't think he's getting the material to back up what he could bring to Bond.
As the countdown begins to the 21st century, it's good to know there is still one number you can always count on.
Bond.
Bond.
Can't you just say hello like a normal person?
Renard is behind this.
You will die along with everyone in the city.
We do not negotiate with terrorists.
His only goal is chaos.
For the world's greatest secret agent.
You've defused hundreds of these, right?
When the stakes are high.
Yeah, but they're usually standing still.
Life's full of small challenges.
And the danger hits too close to home.
Bomb!
It's not just professional.
Someone's tampered with the bomb.
It's personal.
I have to get it back, or somebody's gonna have my butt.
First things first.
The world is not enough.
In 1999, the world would not be enough. Not enough for Bond, and not enough for Brosnan, and especially not enough for us. Okay? Because...
Well, this is okay. All right. We did the streamlined Bond.
Yeah.
It played well around the world. It made money. Mm-hmm. But yet, I think some of the grumblings that you and I were mentioning just a few moments ago were probably going on inside the camp, too. And they wanted to try and do more with Bond, mm-hmm. you know? So I think the two writers, Neil Purvis and Robert Wade, you know, when they were working on this story, I think they were making attempts to try and expand out and play around with the formula just a little bit, mm-hmm. at least. And I think the first sign was bringing in Michael Apted as a director.
Well, that was a strange choice.
And not an action director at all.
Right.
I mean, Coal Miner's Daughter, right?
Well,
the Up series.
Gorillas in the Mist.
Right.
Nell. Thunderheart, you know?
I mean, but to me, this is an actor's director.
Sure.
So when he was announced, I thought, oh, this is great for the character of James Bond.
Right.
And for Brosnan. And maybe we'll get some good dramatic side, because... Let's face it, I trust Arthur Wooster and the second unit stunt team to do the action scenes well.
Sure.
They've been doing it for, 19 films now?
Well,
so.
What can you say about the opening boat chasing? It's absolutely phenomenal.
And it's the longest Bond opening scene. Think about it. It's almost 17 minutes before the credits.
Right. Well, they have an opening scene where he does the deal where he goes out the window on the rope.
Well, normally there would be an action beat and then the credits would come, but they keep going.
Right.
And I think it's interesting. It just kind of sets the tone that this Bond film is going to be a little different.
Check this out. The pre-credit sequence runs approximately 15 minutes.
The
longest of any Bond film to date. Originally, the pre-credit sequence was to end after Bond's leap out of the Swiss banker's office. But feedback from test screenings indicated the audience wanted something bigger.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, yeah, I mean, that would have not been good enough. For
right.
the opening scene, but the boat scene definitely was. I mean, it was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it was. And I think, you know, after the boat scene, we see something else that's kind of rare and new. Bond is hurt and
right.
injured.
Right.
And that's kind of a new element. And I really like how he gets back on the roster by seducing his doctor. Because
yeah.
we get that great moment between the doctor and Moneypenny where Moneypenny knows what's going on.
Yeah.
Kind of gives it a look. So I'm all good. I'm on the page, and it's like, okay, this is a decent Bond movie. It's starting out good. I liked Electric King.
I was afraid to be alone. I was afraid to be in the crowd. I was afraid to do anything at all. Until I realized I can't hide in the shadows.
As a concept and as a character,
yeah.
and having a female, a strong female, that would end up turning the tables on Bond, I liked a lot.
Yeah.
Thought that was good. And I thought she was introduced well. The skiing scene is nice. I think it's kind of silly when all the little, whatever, snowmobile machines.
The flying bugs, yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of silly. I mean, I know that they're real because I'm seeing them and it's all happening.
Yeah.
But it didn't seem the most practical way to get that particular job done. It's like, I think you could have done it a little bit cheaper, guys. You didn't need these machines, you know? Couple of skis and a nice rifle.
but then everything would change and the movie would get great when we got up to Christmas Jones.
Dr. Jones. Christmas Jones. And don't make any jokes, I've heard them all.
Well, see, again, what are we in? About an hour in now?
Yeah.
When she shows up and it just falls right off.
Yeah.
I mean, when he saves Elektra, it's nice. You know, he's got the big old coat that saves her underground, and because of her fear and the way they come together, I like it.
Right.
It works. I like the fact that, you know, she knows about his injury and is able to use that against him with Renard.
Right.
And that scene where Renard gets him, I like it. Because Bond could have taken him out right there. What does Bond do? He talks! He's guilty, you know?
Too much damn talking.
Too much talking, Bond. You're going to learn one of these days.
Yep.
But, and Renard's an interesting character.
You can't kill me. I'm already dead.
Yeah. Not dead enough for me.
I like Robert Carlyle, and I like the idea that, you know, he's on a short lifespan.
Yeah.
And, you know, can't feel the pain. But cartoonish right after that. I mean, really, Christmas Jones.
Who was the who had the great idea of casting her as a physicist, you know what I mean, as a nuclear person? It's just like, give me a freaking break.
Doesn't exactly take a degree in nuclear physics.
Yeah, I didn't think her chemistry with Brosnan was really particularly strong either. He was a lot better with Sophie Marceau.
Yeah, but see, what happened to me also is that the film gets so talky and slows down that, you know, it actually gets boring. It's like, God, I'm falling asleep here. What is the problem? And it took me like two sittings to get to the damn thing. And it's just like, you know, I mean, when they went to the oil pipe and they went down the oil pipe, I mean, that was kind of cool. Of course, I mean, there's nothing to that. That's all just CGI, you know. But,
well, you know, it's an interesting scene because they got to defuse the bomb and right. Then Bond learns what's really going on. But really, what happens next? M gets kidnapped.
Oh, God, that was awful.
And put behind that makeshift little prison thing.
And remember later on, she'd come up to him, Electra would come up to him and says, "It's time for you to die, M."
"It's time for you to die."
And it's kind of like, okay, pull the gun and cap her.
Yeah.
No.
I mean, what's all this, like, about, really? Just all this posing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, by this time, I just think it's off the rails and... I don't know. I like the moment where M is able to watch Bond do his job
and take
against Elektra and take her out.
You wouldn't kill me. You'd miss me.
Yes.
Die, Bond!
I never miss.
It's a good moment.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's just one moment.
Well, and did you know that this is
stretch.
This is the first Bond movie where Bond kills a Bond girl?
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't know that. I mean, that's interesting.
That's I like that. I mean...
It's the first Bond movie where the main villain is a woman.
Yeah. So these are dynamics that I give in a plus column for writing a Bond movie. I think there were some good intentions there to try to make something with a little bit more substance than The World Is Not Enough, because she's a better villain than Elliot Carver.
Absolutely.
But... ultimately, the film is underwhelming and ends up being worse.
Well, and it's just dumb at the end. You know, it's like, I don't even understand what the hell was going on. What was the mechanics of the sub? He's trying to take that big bullet thing and put it in the hole and poison the, you know, the what in there? The nuclear fission or whatever? I mean, I don't know. Excuse me for being stupid on this. But it's like, I didn't know what the hell was going on. Then Bond... goes up and pulls some kind of a wiring somewhere, some kind of tubing, and turns a switch and it shoots out at him. It's like, how the hell did he know how to do that? You know, yeah. I mean, has he been working on those subs? I mean, I mean, he knows.
He is a commander, if you want James Bond spin, but
well,
come on.
Sure, but how long has it been since he's been a naval commander? You know, quite a while. I just thought it was weak and confusing and I don't know. I just thought it was just... very underwhelming, like you said.
And I think the writing was on the wall, although it was a successful Bond. It made money, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's number 10 out of 20.
I mean, that's amazing.
It's right there in the middle.
Considering how many better entries there are in the series.
Right, right. No, it's out of the admissions, it's number 10. It grossed $390.6 million worldwide. I mean, you know, Tomorrow Never Dies was number 11. Hmm. So it even did better than Tomorrow Never Dies. I think that, you know... a lot of it had to do with that opening sequence. I mean, that sold. I mean, you put that all over the trailers and the commercials.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they put a lot into that. I mean, they built 35 boats for that opening chase scene.
Wow.
So, I mean, it was a huge deal, and I think that's how they sold it. And I mean, if you look at the trailer for it, it looks hot. But then you get there,
well,
and it's
sure.
just like Snoreville.
Yeah.
So, yeah, got to take a big old passeroony on that one. I would consider it absolutely one of my least favorites of the entire series.
As a Bond fan, at this point, it's like cup half empty, half full.
Right.
I don't ever feel 100% satisfied coming out of these movies.
Right.
It's like I'm really behind Brosnan,
yeah.
but I'm not getting a great movie. I'm getting like half a great movie.
Right.
And a quarter of a great movie. And it was frustrating because what would come next would follow the formula, follow the new mold.
Right. Well, why would they change it? I mean, they're making money, right?
Right.
They're making that cash. The films are doing well.
I would have to wait one more film for them to address my concerns. But yes, it is a cash cow. And the Brosnans are making in more money than any of them in the series, I think.
Yeah.
I think, aren't they some of the most financially successful?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
They're playing worldwide, and I guess, fans are generally happy.
Yeah. Well, but I think they probably had the same viewpoint that what we're talking about. You walk away with moments where you say, well, I love this moment, I love that moment. But at the end, it was like, you know, I wanted to run out of the theater. And one last thing I'd say for World Is Not Enough is that this is the last time we've seen Desmond Llewellyn as Q.
As Q, you're right.
Yeah.
And I have to say that, I mean, obviously the writers knew. They were bringing in John Cleese.
Right.
Grooming him, but I really like his exit scene.
Yeah.
It's really nice.
Now, pay attention, 007. I've always tried to teach you two things. First, never let them see you bleed.
And the second?
Always have an escape plan.
And as a Q fan, just seeing him go down, that look on his face, it's a really sweet moment.
Well, and the funny thing is that wasn't necessarily going to be his last appearance, but it ended up working out that way because he was killed in a car accident.
Of all things. That's just so sad.
Of all things. You know, not old age. He didn't get sick. He
right.
just was killed in a car accident on his way home from somewhere. I think a book signing I read. And, you know, but at least they had that scene, you know, have an escape plan. It's just, and it worked so perfectly. And at least we got that last great send-off from him. And I think that John Cleese stepped up really well and was a blast.
He did. And it, if it's one thing, it makes the Bond viewer have to go through that movie, if only for that.
Absolutely. Totally worth it.
When danger becomes a temptation, when every move brings you closer to the edge, when you live each day like it's your last, there's a surprise around every curve. Day.
To die another day.
The year was 2002. Die another day.
We waited 3 years for this one.
That's right.
Which led me to believe, okay, they're taking the extra year to make it better.
Right.
Good.
Right.
I like the selection of Lee Tamahori. Not because he's a cross-dresser. But because he directed a movie called Once for Warriors.
Yeah.
A New Zealand film. And I didn't know anything about it, but when I saw it, not only did it have a good command of style, but it had explosive performances in it.
Yeah.
And a raw, gritty style. And it was just one of those films where you notice the filmmaking and you go, this guy's good. And he came to Hollywood and made nothing but dud after dud.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's not really fair. Mulholland Falls, and then did another one called The Edge with Anthony Hopkins.
Along Came a Spider.
And Along Came a Spider. And The Edge is not bad. It's very well shot.
Yeah.
In terms of the production of mm-hmm. the film. It's just the David Mamet script on it was just sort of okay.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just think he was a director that had never really had, like, the ball player that just really hadn't found his swing in the majors,
yeah.
if you will. But so I had promise for him coming in as a Bond film. And I think it was completely realized when the opening sequence occurred.
Right.
I mean, that surfing is fantastic.
Yeah, it's a great way to enter.
I mean, Laird Hamilton and those other guys on the board, it's real.
Yeah.
That ain't CGI.
Yeah.
Now, I know that's not Pierce Brosnan, but that doesn't matter.
No, that's fine, as long as it's...
It's James Bond is what it is.
Sure.
And I love that, and I think it works really nice up until, you know, the little disguise and the switching of places and, you know, all of the whole opening of Bond getting captured and tortured over the credits made me feel like this is going to be different.
Right.
Actually, when the bullet came out of Brosnan's gun on the opening credit,
yeah,
that's when I knew something was off. I think, okay, this is going to be different.
Yeah.
And I know that there's 20 homages or 19 homages from every Bond movie in this movie.
Right. That's one of the fun things about this movie is they went in and did it. And if you've seen all the movies, it's fun to try to place those. And I went as far as finding a detailed list on everything. And a lot of it is just suggestive. But, I mean, things as simple as when Halle Berry walks out of the water and she's got the knife belt on.
Right,
which is an obvious tip of the hat to Dr. No, you know, exactly.
I liked him having the Birds of the West by James Bond book.
Right.
I thought that was a nice
touch. Is exactly what he was named after. But, yeah, and things like when he went into the archives.
So, this is where they keep the old relics in, eh?
You see the plane that Roger Moore flew in.
Right,
Octopussy,
and the alligator.
And the alligator from Octopussy. It's the best.
Oh, and the jetpack from Thunderball.
Does this still work?
I mean, that is, that's one of my favorite sequences in the movie. It's just so much fun.
Right.
And I like the idea that when Q says, here's your 20th watch.
Now, new watch, this will be your 20th, I believe.
For some reason, I just love that line. It's like, well, that's appropriate,
yeah.
You know? 20th mission, 20th watch. I love it. But the way they did the opening credits, too, is creative. And blending in Bond's torturing with the credit. And, you know, coming in having Madonna and her electronic effect.
Yeah, and I like that song. I know you said you didn't like it, but I actually like the song.
I'm not a big fan of the song. I'm a big fan of the sequence. And
yeah.
I think the song is fine over the sequence.
Yeah.
But as a song by itself, I don't think it really is strong.
Well, it's
really
just strong. I like the electronic sound of it, but it all worked well, and I was totally down with it. I mean, the opening sequence was great. The pre-credit title action sequence, I mean, and
The handoff, the trade off with Zhao is a good little plot point.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that works, and then you get Falcone.
Oh my God, Michael Madsen.
Bond got away real fast, didn't he?
And I'm guessing they're trying to replace Joe Don Baker. He's going to be the American connection. And I just knew that he would probably be a recurring role. And
you better clean your house or I will.
Listen, you put your house in order or we're going to do it for you.
God, it's like, what are you going to bite, little doggy? You know, he puts his...
What, are you going to smoke me to death?
I know, he puts his cigarette in his mouth and starts playing with it. It's like moving all around. It's like... Can't you just see him saying, hey, Lee, I want to try this thing with a cigarette in my mouth. It's like, stop. You know, you're wrong for this role. That was a miscast, I'm sorry to say. And I don't hate Michael Madsen, but just not good. But I'm guessing John Cleese is officially Q now.
You know, you're cleverer than you look.
Still better than looking cleverer than you are.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I always thought he would be R, which was a funny gag as an idea. But no, he is Q, and I guess it's Q Branch.
Right, so it's just a title.
So,
but anyways, at this point, you know, like we said, it had a great opening. And it, like the other films, it's on this rail, and you're thinking this is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, the Cuba scene is good. It's nice. It's a good locale.
And I think Halle Berry is not – I mean, I enjoy her character. I think Jinx is an interesting character. I don't know that she handled it so well.
Jacinta Johnson. Our friends call me Jinx.
And, you know, I think the whole health clinic idea is kind of interesting, I guess.
Yeah.
Kind of sci-fi-y, though. I mean, we're kind of getting closer into Moonraker territory over here.
Well, if anything, this is the sci-fi movie. I mean, you know, we'll get to this later on, but the technology in this movie is way beyond anything that... As there's ever
it's taken
been
a huge leap.
Well, I mean, this is Star Trek technology here. I mean, and everything was fine. We were in Cuba. We did the health scene, and they blew that up. And then of course here's where the movie derailed. And you got to agree with me on this. Is it when Jinx decides to dive off the cliff backwards?
Oh, it's that crummy CGI.
100% CGI looks.
See,
like
in the
hell.
Old days, they would have found someone to make a record die.
Exactly.
And they would have gotten it on film.
What? That's inherently more interesting. And to me, I mean, that's why I call this film the CGI Bond, is because they decided, they said, these plot elements are more important than the actual stunt. Meaning, like, it's more important for us to see her dive off this cliff.
Backwards.
Backwards, and get this dramatic, unbelievable shot than to really see it happen in real life. And to me,
I'd rather have a diver go off forwards and really dive off.
Well, to me, the absolute bottom rule should be, if you can't do it in the real world, you're not doing it.
Yeah, don't do it.
You know, because it's corny. And later on, it'll go all the way down the hill when we get the, you know, we might as well talk about it now. You know, when he's out there with that speed card, you know, running away from the laser from space.
Oh.
And then it melts the glacier, and then we get the, what do you even call that?
That parasailing or whatever?
The parasail, skiing on the water.
Snow sail thing.
And it's 100% CGI, and it looks like just...
It's bad PlayStation 2 graphics.
Yeah, it's like Jar Jar Binks, you know, surfing in water. I mean, it's like, why are we going here? This has not happened in a Bond film before. If we're going to do it for real. Obviously, you can't, you know, melt a glacier. And, I mean, that's the story elements are so big, you know.
Well, and the thing is there's other ways to do it. Okay, if you got to go with the melt a glacier, you can still do the laser beam hitting the glacier. Cut to the miniature of the glacier exploding.
Right.
It's a real miniature ice, and you can just explode it. And then cut to a skier with an avalanche behind him or something,
yeah.
You know? I mean, I bet there's ways that you could fake it for real better than the CGI method.
Yeah.
I don't know. You're right. It is off the rails, and it's taking what could have been, what started out as what I thought as a very strong, promising Bond.
Right.
I mean, I love it when he escapes from MI6 in captivity.
Yeah.
Slows down his heart. He's got that big Robinson Crusoe beard and,
yeah.
You know, just shows up in Hong Kong Harbor and walks into that hotel.
Mr. Bond, so good to see you. It's been a long time.
Yeah.
Oh, it's smooth. It's great.
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
I want the film to continue with all that promise. And literally the Ice Palace, it's just, as soon as he drives into the Ice Palace, it's just off the rails.
Well, and we even have fun with the fencing scene, you know, where Madonna shows up in her little role.
I see you handle your weapon well.
I have been known to keep my tip up.
It's a good action scene.
Yeah,
it's
and then
good.
He fights this Gustav Graves guy.
Are you a gambling man, Mr. Bond?
And, you know, that's a fun little scene. And you're right. As soon as we go to the Ice Palace, it all starts going downhill.
It's only by being on the edge that we know who we really are. Under the skin.
And it doesn't get better. It just gets worse.
I miss the kill.
Well, there's a name to die for.
And, you know, we got the can't trust your bomb babe.
Yeah, Miranda Frost. You know, when she turned around and pointed that gun at Bond, I wanted to start throwing monkey shit, man. That was so stupid. I'm just like, please. And she was hot, man. She was really gorgeous. But, you know, that's so typical that they would do that. But, you know, there's always someone on the inside.
Well, yeah.
Tired of that. And
I thought I was going to like her because I like that scene she has with M.
Yeah.
And M is sort of talking to her, and she goes, certainly not James Bond.
I think he's a blunt instrument whose primary method is to provoke and confront.
Yeah.
You know? Because you know he's going to get her, so
it's
fun.
Of course.
You know, so.
But after the last film, do we have to have another woman who Bond is...
Oh, no. It's like, again.
Yeah, it's like he just slept with her, and now, okay, no. Oh, no, she's really the bad guy. I mean, what does she win? You know, money? I mean, what does she get out of going with... You know,
well, and also there's a big plot hole too. You know, she supposedly took the bullets out of Bond's gun
right.
in the bed.
It was so good of you to bring your gun to bed with us.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But Bond knows what a gun feels like without bullets in it.
Yeah.
There's a different weight to the gun. This is movie logic, and it's bullshit. Okay? Bond is too smart. He will, of course, know the weight of the gun is different without the proper ammunition in it. So I don't buy that at all.
Yeah.
Come on, writers. I mean, I've just sat through 19 of these movies, okay?
Now, let me give you some more stupid movie logic, okay? And it's like, please, you've got to change this. Is number all right, two times and they could have taken out Jinx in the Ice Palace, okay? One, she's all hooked up to the laser table, right? And, of course, the guy says, we don't have a diamond mine here, but we still have lasers. Why do you freaking have lasers if you don't have a diamond mine? Just to kill people? And then Zal says, I'm going to kill her. And the guy says, no, let's use the laser. He could have just...
Oh, I know.
He could have
That's about the stupidest thing.
Could have put a bullet in her head right then, boom, over with. But no, let's use the lasers. That'll be fun. And then he uses the super slow laser. Just so Bond can get there in time. Okay, fine. It makes for an interesting... element of a fight, you know, when they had the lasers flying everywhere.
It's stupid.
But the point is that to get to there, it was moronic. Now, here's my other stupid one. This one's even worse, okay? They put Jinx in the ice room, right? And they locked the doors. Could they have put a bullet in her head right then? Absolutely. Pow, she's down. No. What he'd rather do is point his giant satellite in the sky and blow the sun onto the ice house, melt the entire frickin' ice house so she'll drown in it. Okay.
Oh.
How many millions
of
dollars?
They can't trace that back to you.
Yeah, exactly. How many millions of dollars is that going to cost, you know, to melt the ice house off your billion-dollar satellite? My point is that you could have just put a bullet in her head. You know, it's like, please.
A couple of times. Get it over with.
That's the thing I'm saying is that we're at film number 20 now, and whereas Blofeld explaining his plan to Bond in the 60s is one thing, or in a film like Moonraker or something that's totally over the top, today, you know, it's like, come on, we've been there, we've done that. You've got to stop the stupidity.
Yeah, hasn't these villains ever seen a Bond movie?
Exactly.
I mean, certainly they've seen Austin Powers. Yeah. I mean, there's just no excuse. But I think it's a pretty weak title. Die Another Day doesn't really do a lot for me.
Yeah, and how about that guy's RoboCop suit?
Oh, that's stupid.
When the guy says, you can't make this small enough, do something different with it.
Does the word ergonomics mean anything to you?
And he puts it into a suit. He looks like RoboCop walking around. What did that guy do that in like 20 minutes?
I know.
You know? Oh, hey, okay, I'll make it into a suit. You know, really quick. Please, it's just like stupid, stupid movie logic.
I mean, at least the last movie's title, The World Is Not Enough, was Bond's coat of arms.
Right.
So at least there's kind of a nice tie-in, but Tomorrow Never Dies and Die Another Day are just kind of weak attempts at a Bond title, I always thought.
Now, why does the title Die have to be in there?
God, let's put a moratorium on that one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you know, and the last thing you kind of mentioned is, you know, I'm still waiting for that Jinx movie to come out.
Oh, God,
bitch.
I had to laugh at that kind of thing. Like, they're really going to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, they wrote a script. They actually tried to develop it. And then Broccoli said, no, we're not going to do a Jinx movie.
Well, they actually had talked about doing a Wei Lin movie also for Michelle Yeoh's character.
Well, great. Does that mean I'm going to get a Dr. Goodhead movie?
That's exactly right. Or a movie for Plunge O'Toole? Oh, yeah. So
No. Let's just concentrate on making good Bond films, not trying to spin off bad Jinx movies.
Bitch.
Just, I think it's a horrible idea.
Your mama.
And that's how that would all end up. And I think that a lot of people do like Die Another Day. I've heard, you know, a lot of people say it's their favorite Brosnan. And if you look at it from a high-tech perspective and you let it be a Star Wars type of an action flick and you don't worry about, you know, some of the, you know, the CGI doesn't really bug you, you're on a fun little roller coaster. And I guess
some
you can
good
have
visceral action in it, to be sure.
Sure. And, you know, and it's not like, you know, Brosnan, again, you know, came and did a crappy job. You know, like you said before, I think he's tied to these scripts, and, you know, what can you do about it?
You know, there is one thing I liked about Die Another Day. There's at least a good line I think Zhao has when he punches Bond.
How's that for a punchline?
He goes, how's that for a punchline?
No. Ooh. Well, you know.
You can hear, like, the crickets in the audience.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, it didn't even get to as bad as, like I said earlier, the Star Trek technology in this movie that drove me nuts with the, you know, it was
invisible car?
Well, we have the invisible car.
Aston Martin call it the Vanquish, we call it the Vanish.
Okay.
We got that first, right?
We got that first, and your mind is trying so hard to get into that. You're like, okay. I'm going to believe it.
Okay, the reflective mirrors and the surface.
Adaptive camouflage. Tiny cameras on all sides project the image they see onto a light-emitting polymer skin on the opposite side. You see, to the casual eye, it's as good as invisible.
It doesn't really make sense, but okay.
Yeah, I'll try to roll with it. But by the time we got to remember the training sequence?
Oh, the VR goggles?
And the VR goggles. It's basically a freaking holodeck. And it's like, okay, look. This is Star Trek technology. I'm sorry. You've gone too far over the edge with this. And then the way they play with it at the end with the whole Money Penny scene, you know, with the, you know, it's the first time we get to see Bond and Moneypenny actually go for it. And so everybody's thinking, yes, yes.
That seems to me the only reason to have those goggles in the movie.
Right.
Because the training sequence is stupid.
Yeah.
At least the Moneypenny one makes sense on a conceptual level.
Right.
Bond training with the VR glasses was just dumb. Because what the hell does that have to do with the natural world?
Yeah.
Nothing. Get out there on an obstacle course. Or some kind of maze course or whatever. And you got to do, if you're going to train, you got to do it in a real setting. Well, you can't do it in fantasy land.
They were trying to take it to so far to the tech levels. Like, let's take this technology just so far beyond any place it's ever been before. It's not even believable. You know, I mean.
But it's not even necessary. And this is the problem. They're making choices that are just not needed.
Yeah.
It didn't have to go there.
Well, it didn't even.
It didn't have to be an invisible car. I mean, these are just. These are like wild, kind of gee whiz, 12-year-old kid would enjoy choices. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're just so fleeting.
Well, thank God, because in the end, something would happen. We'd have to wait a few years, but, you know, everything is going to change big time.
This may be too much for a blunt instrument to understand. Any thug can kill. I want you to take your ego out of the equation.
So you want me to be half monk, half hitman?
I knew it was too early to promote you.
Well, I understand 00s have a very short life expectancy.
Four years, but it's time for the reboot.
Just think about it. If you started high school, you went all the way through high school without a Bond movie.
Yeah, that's incredible. 4 years. But and we were hurting for one. But remember when they first announced Daniel Craig? We were like, oh, no, wrong. Blonde. James Blonde.
The blonde never bothered me personally.
Yeah.
Because I don't recall Ian Fleming writing down what color hair James Bond had. And if he did, I sure as hell don't remember. And I'm not going to hold the films to it. Because if what if Fleming said it was a different color than Connery's? Is suddenly Connery wrong? No. So I'll let each Bond come in with their hair color and their look. Because obviously Brosnan's hair is a lot darker than Moore's.
Right.
And so it's, you know, I don't know. That never bothered me. But having seen Craig in Layer Cake, there's a Steve McQueen quality about him.
Yeah, definitely.
That I like.
Mm-hmm.
There's a quietness and there's a presence. He can do a lot more without words than some actors can with words.
Yeah,
he's got a really good physical presence, and he's a good actor. He's got great line delivery. So I didn't think that was going to be a problem. I liked the idea, too, of them going back to Casino Royale, but it was hard to know what kind of Bond movie they were going to make.
Right.
and Die Another Day, I didn't know, are they going to continue in that direction? Or are they really going to do what Quentin Tarantino wanted to do and reboot and go back and do it Ian Fleming style?
Right.
And do it low end and no gadgets and kind of keep it real and keep the emotions, hard-edged.
Well, I mean, really, when you sit down and start watching this film, I mean, it's really, you don't know where you're going to go. Where are they going to take us with this thing? And straight off the bat, they destroy all the formulas and just saying, oh, we're not going to open up with the bullet shot.
Yeah, no gun barrel. And I'm like,
Yep.
But there's that other side of me that's going, okay, that's on purpose.
Yeah.
Just be patient. And you almost got to be that way watching this movie. If you're a Bond fan, you've been through 20.
Yeah.
It's almost like, okay, I just got to sit back. Because literally, I really like the opening sequence in black and white.
Absolutely.
Em really doesn't mind you earning a little money on the side, Dryden. She'd just prefer it if it wasn't selling secrets.
Specifically, I liked the second black and white in the flashback in the opening sequence. And if you hear what I'm talking about here, you're hearing about an editing technique that's never been used in a Bond movie.
How did he die? Your contact? Not well.
So already this film is scoring points for me. I know stylistically and with the film grammar, it can go anywhere.
Right.
And that opens up possibilities. And that's a brutal action sequence.
Oh, yeah.
And it's nice because they can do it in slivers.
Well, and then we still get our bullet shot anyways.
And that's when the film started to win me over. I went, the origin of the bullet shot. How freaking cool.
Well, think about the bullet shot. It's because before he's always been just with a white background or something. Now it's the real world setting.
Well, exactly. It's like, this is what you do. This is like Batman Begins, Star Wars, a la. When you write a prequel in Smallville, those geek out moments.
Yeah.
You know, those things that you write in there that will affect the way you look at everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so now that opening bullet shot in the beginning of every Bond is now has a context.
Right.
And it's a lot of fun. And when it pulled back and that song kicked on.
Yeah.
And I had not heard the Chris Cornell song yet. And I kind of like to do that. I like to hear the song for the first time in the movie and watch the credit sequences. But right away, it's like, this is a new Bond, not just a new actor, but this feels different.
Well, and look at the opening, at the credit sequence with that Daniel Kleinman did. He's back from Brosnan, but it's a very different opening. There's no women in it,
and it's all animated in a very different way.
Right.
I like the idea of the bodies breaking apart and all the hearts, clubs and spades and all the cards. And there was something I noticed too, like on the Queen card, it sort of morphs into Vesper's face and then back into the Queen.
Wow,
a lot of nice little subtleties in there.
Yeah,
it's a unique piece of work, and it's unlike any Bond opening title sequence ever. And like you were right, no women, but it's appropriate, I think, for the conception of what this film is all about.
Right. No, I think that, see, the problem is that going in, all the formula is working against you here. Because you're saying, oh, it's not like the formula, it's not like the formula, it's not like the formula. But then if you just let it be what it is, you're like, hey, this is pretty damn cool, and I can jive with this song, and I like these credits. They're different, but at the same time, that's okay. Everything's different. This is the biggest reboot we've ever seen. We've seen the reboots before. But none like this. This is the fierce reboot. This is the Jack Bauer 24 reboot.
Yeah, and I think that's a good way to put it, because we're bringing back Martin Campbell.
Right.
But the direction has grown a lot since GoldenEye.
Oh, man, it's fierce.
It does not look like it's directed by the same guy.
Not at all.
And at all. I don't
it's
know
like,
if
who's,
that's...
Who's, who is this guy that is going to join the ranks, of Die Hard director? What's his name?
Oh, McTiernan. It looked like a McTiernan-Cameron-type movie.
Yeah.
It looked like it had their appropriate punch, their visceral punch.
Right.
You're not seeing the shaky handheld, I'm going to do a little zoom in and zoom out and all that crap.
Exactly.
It's just well-composed, tight, efficient filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it just explodes in the opening chase scene.
Oh,
in
man.
The construction.
Well, first of all, there's only one thing that I'm hearing in the background during the first chase scene. You know what that music is. That's exactly right. I'm hearing my B-13 music.
You know what I was really sold on Daniel Craig?
Mm.
It's that opening sequence when the guy takes off running and he's sitting there, arms folded, and he waits, and then boom, he's off.
Yeah.
And he's got that one swift all-in-one movement, and he's on top of that roof.
Yeah.
And I got that you only live twice feeling for a moment.
Yeah.
You know, when he's running across that roof and it's looking down and hops on that thing.
No, absolutely. Well, and the man is fierce. And you know, I mean, they did a great job, you know, with the stunt doubles, because you can't tell who is who. It looks like Daniel Craig the entire time when he's running
up. Well, you believe it's him.
Yeah.
Look how buff he is, and look how well he moves. Why wouldn't that be him? Well, that's him running up that crane.
When he's running up that crane, that is absolutely, it's like, oh my God, there's no fear in you. Yeah. You know, I mean, you're like the freaking Martin Riggs of Bond. You know, I mean, that's really who I thought of was Martin Riggs. And it's just like, you know, Jack Bauer wouldn't even go here. And I just think that kind of fierceness, you know what I mean? And like you said, that first chase scene, it's just like, you know, and then they get on top of there, and then they got the guy with the face gets a chance to shoot him, and there's no bullets in the gun. There is no, Mr. Vaughn, I've got you now.
And he does the smart thing. He throws a gun at him, but Bond catches
it. Oh, God, did you just yell? I was just like, yes. Oh, I was like, God damn, give me a rewind button, please. Yeah,
there was a lot of rewind moments, specifically a lot of the B-13 District 13 moments.
Oh, how about the moment where he goes through the little window, just like in B-13? It's probably an homage to it.
Oh, you know it is, because Bond responds by blasting through the wall.
Just through the wall, and you're just like, yes, that's my guy right there.
Well, it's a double punch to the audience, because when that guy went through that little window, you could hear a gasp in the audience.
Right,
like, wow. And then, boom, Bond comes through and they're laughing.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, the film is just working.
Yeah.
And it's working really well. And it proves another point when they're on top of that crane and he jumps from one to another and then from the crane on down. And this is something, you know, we've been saying now for 3 episodes. But if you needed the proof, it's now final and clear. The audience, when they see something that's real and they see the stunt, they react. I can hear it.
Right.
You can feel it in the audience. You can hear the gasping.
Right.
I never hear that when a CGI sequence is on screen, and haven't, literally, probably since Jurassic Park, maybe T2. But seeing all of these real stunts, people knew they were real, and you know, it was just better. And I think I would be hard-pressed to find someone who doesn't agree.
Absolutely. And I mean, the only word I can think of is just fierce. It was just fierce all the way. Remember, you had told me the action scenes had a 3-act structure to them almost.
Yeah, that's what it felt like. They go on a little bit longer than a typical action scene. And it felt like, there was Act 1, Act 2, and Act 3 to each major set piece. I mean, specifically the chase and the airport truck scene.
Right.
You know, each of that. I mean, that one had a great 3rd act payoff when the bomb was finally revealed.
Yep. Well, think about the scene in, like you said, the 3rd act when he gets into the embassy, and you know he's got the guy, and then all the soldiers come out, and he's got to get rid of his gun, and for once he actually uses that license to kill. There's no talking. There's no oh no, I'm going to put my gun down and hope I get out of this. It's pop pop pop.
His exit plan was formed. Right there the moment he saw that gate lock.
Right.
Okay, all right, I know how to get around this.
I think that's the difference here. There's no intellectual assent. There is no Bond thinking, well, I'll get out of this like this. I'll let them take me captive, and I'll be able to talk my way out of it. Or they won't just put a gun to my head and blow me away, you know?
Well, and it works perfectly into Bond is rough. He's not seasoned yet.
Right.
He's not the tuxedo Bond that we've come to know and love.
Right.
And, I mean, 2 moments that I really loved as a Bond fan was, 1, how he won the 64 Aston Martin.
Absolutely.
I just glee.
Geek
you know,
out moment.
Watching that.
Yeah.
Just glee. And the second one, I specifically liked his relationship with Vesper Lynd. I thought that was really strong.
Good evening, Mr. Bond.
Good evening, Miss Lynd.
How he got the tux. And how she had it for him, and it was tailored. And, you know, the first time he looked at himself in the mirror in the tux, it's just great.
It's like he was putting on the Superman uniform or something.
Exactly. And, I mean, if you've gone through 20 films and suffered through some of the lesser ones, when a film is working so well for so long, it's a revelation.
Yeah.
I mean, because you're so surprised at how good it all is. And You know, you're not even thinking about not liking Daniel Craig.
All right, he just nailed it from all
he's
the way
just,
through.
He's just Bond, and you're on it, and you want more from him. That's all.
You know, I can't get over. You know, we get to the action sequences, and you know, we're in the plane scene, and I mean, it's just one to the next, and then he runs up those stairs, jumps on that truck, and then he does something that to me, you know, I almost soiled my pants because it's everything that doesn't happen today. You know, he gets up on that ladder car, and he just runs right to the front and dives into the front window, knocking the guy out. You know, mm-hmm. And it's just like, that is so stinking badass. You know, I can't even deal with how cool that is. You know, no, I'm going to climb the car for 10 minutes and hang on and get drug around. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just going to stand up and run. I mean, it's just a completely new Bond.
Well, and I think 24 has certainly set the bar for a type of fierce agent versus terror type scenario. How refreshing was Le Chiffre, a real villain?
Weeping blood comes merely from a derangement of the tear duct, my dear general. Nothing sinister.
I mean, I liked him, you know, and I thought his situation was realistic.
Yeah.
And what he was trying to do was a perfect foe for Bond to go up against.
The bleeding eye was pretty sick.
I liked when Bond got poisoned. I thought that was a great sequence.
That was great.
And just when he came and sat back down again.
I'm sorry. That last hand nearly killed me.
Just a lot of fun. And, you know, ultimately, I think it accomplishes what it needed to do in training Bond.
Yeah.
This is his training film, his training mission. But not only the physicality he goes through, but the emotionality is appropriate to set the stage for future adventures.
Well, see, and that's the deal. He's not perfect. He's still learning. This is not the Bond who knows how to do everything. Because you look at him and you say, well, he's making some mistakes. He's doing some things. He's doing things that Bond wouldn't do. Well, of course he is. It's because he's not really Bond yet.
But he's doing some things right, like, you know, learning where M lives and what her name is.
And how the hell did you find out where I lived?
Same way I found out your name. I thought M was a randomly assigned letter. I had no idea it stood for...
Utter one more syllable and I'll have you killed.
Yeah. That was great. She's like, don't you say it.
And like when he knows her password. How does he keep finding out these things?
Yeah, that's great. That's great. So, yeah, I mean, what can you say? I can tell you this. I'm ready to go back. And I know you've seen it twice, and I'm...
When was the last time you said that about a movie?
Well, the problem is that I've said it before about a movie, but I've never said, I want to see it again right now.
We didn't feel that way after Superman Returns.
Yeah, no. I was ready to
go. We didn't feel that way after X-Men The Last Stand.
But, you know, at the end of this film, I have to tell you that, you know, when he was getting ready to go after Mr. White, I was wanting another big set piece. Now, this is strange because this is the longest Bond film ever made.
It is. 8 minutes longer than Majesty, I think.
Exactly. And so it's really surprising that I was ready to keep going. I wanted another big action scene. And
it's the 24 vibe where you just keep going and going and going.
I guess so. It's like, if it's good, just let it keep rolling, man. But it was. And I wanted another huge set piece for him to get to Mr. White. And so when it ended, I was like, oh, man, that's kind of disappointing. No, it wasn't. It left me wanting more. And it took me a while. It took me a couple hours of sitting there thinking about it to go, yeah, you know, that's what it was. It's that it left me wanting more. I wanted
you
to
really
get to the
do
next...
want a film to do that.
Yeah, well, you want to get to the next film. You want to get to the next story. And it is. It's like 24. It's like, you know, give me another hit of that kick-ass Bond.
Yeah, and let's hope the next one literally does pick up Mr. White in the briefcase and... We can continue this emotional arc that Bond's on and, you know, the training arc.
Right. So, you know, I don't even know. I mean, I can't tell you what the film did wrong. I mean, it had high moments. It had slow moments. I mean, think about the moment in the shower.
Again, I loved it. A film breathed.
Right.
A Bond film breathed. I missed that in movies. And people complain about the running time and, oh, it had too many endings. Well, just don't go to movies then, okay? Don't ruin it for the rest of us that don't mind a pop song that's outside of the 3-minute mold, okay?
Exactly.
But I really like those extra little beats that it had. I mean, the train scene I thought was really nice. Great dialogue between both of them.
So as charming as you are, Mr. Bond, I will be keeping my eye on our government's money and off your perfectly formed house.
You noticed.
Even accountants have imagination.
you know, this is a good way to build characters. And characters that I'm interested in and I care about and that I actually want to see all the way to the end. And
yeah.
I mean, one of my favorite last lines of any Bond movie.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
And then hearing that theme.
Yeah, I mean, don't use the theme at all until the very end when it's finally like, okay, now I'm the James Bond that you know. And it's just like, oh, yeah. And so, you know what? It makes me think the next film should open up on the gunshot.
Well, it will. I think it'll go right back now into what it should be. And it'll be Craig, you know, going through the gun barrel and turning around.
Because now he's...
He's Bond.
He's the Bond that we know.
Yeah.
Or at least the beginning stages of it.
Yeah. No, this is fun. It's fun. I mean, you can't get too technical about the running order and the continuity and the flow with all of these movies.
No, you can't.
Because you'll drive yourself crazy. Yes, Casino Royale could be first, and then Craig could do three or four films, and then Dr. No starts.
Right.
But the clock is all backwards, so you're just going to screw yourself up, because obviously they're not in the Cold War anymore, right?
In the old days, if an agent did something that embarrassing, he'd have the good sense to defect. Christ, I miss the Cold War.
Because Judi Dench mentions it.
Yeah.
that's not the case. But I think it was absolutely essential what they did do in order to sort of breathe some new life and to take the series a little bit further to where we're watching Bond a little bit differently than we have been before. Because we got kind of complacent with Bond, I think. You know, and they were kind of like going through routine missions and... I don't know, I wanted to be harder for the filmmakers, and I think they rose to the challenge. It's interesting to me that the same two guys that wrote the last four movies wrote this.
Yeah.
Or was it the Paul Haggis influence? I don't know.
Right.
But whatever the collaboration, it worked. So I think mission accomplished.
Definitely.
You know, people say, you know, the Bourne movies, oh, it's influenced by Bourne. I think it's far more influenced by 24 than Bourne, but... Not necessarily in the stylistic,
okay.
In the way it's shot.
Okay, let's play some Who Can Kick Who's Ass. Jason Bourne versus new James Bond.
Oh, Bond.
Bond kicks his ass.
Jack Bauer versus Jason Bourne.
Jack Bauer.
Jack Bauer. He's going to take him.
Yeah.
So Jack Bauer versus new James Bond.
New James Bond.
Man, but that's going to be a fight. That's going to be a fight that's going to go on for like an hour and a half.
No. The only person who I can see standing toe-to-toe with Daniel Craig, James Bond, is Martin Riggs, Lethal Weapon 1. Somebody who's a kamikaze.
I'm going to fuck your ass.
Exactly. That's the only one. I mean, who else, you know? I mean, not even Bruce Willis from Die Hard. No way.
Nah.
Nope.
So. Although he can take a beating pretty well.
How can you not love a James Bond who's getting his testicles destroyed, basically, and then says, why don't you hit me again over here and scratch me on the right?
No! To the right!
I know.
You know, I mean, just leave it at that.
Huge laugh from the audience on that one.
I mean,
if they weren't endeared to Craig by then, they were now. And, you know, I'm really sorry this guy had to get beat up for a year in the press.
Yeah.
It was unfounded and it was unfair. But frankly, I don't hear anyone complaining now. I think he has silenced all his critics.
Absolutely.
And, you know, frankly, if you didn't like it, the train has left you behind.
Yep.
Because this train ain't stopping.
It's not going back. We're not going back to the gadgets. You know, sure, he'll get some gadgets, but, you know, we're not going to get an invisible car with this.
We can't go to Die Another Day.
No.
At least you got to wait four more films before you do it.
Yeah, it's going to be a while.
Let's continue on this thread and see where it takes us.
Right.
And I think it'd be interesting. I mean, I know they're going to do an original for the next one, and I really did like seeing, based on the novel by Ian Fleming, in the credits.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why we like it so much.
Maybe.
But would they remake another Bond movie with Craig?
Thunderball!
Oh, wait, sound the alarm! We got water in this new one?
Daniel Craig in Thunderball, produced by Kevin McClory. No, but it wouldn't be Daniel Craig. It would be Pierce Brosnan. So we get a new Bond versus Bond showdown. Oh, man. Anyways, there we go. We have gone through 21 James Bond films.
You know what? Here's a good one-word review for Casino Royale.
Okay.
Blackjack.
Meaning, yes, absolutely. Yeah. 21.
Now the whole world's gonna know that you died scratching my balls.
Okay, so we have been through 21 films now, from Dr. No to Casino Royale. We've seen them all. We talked about them all. You're not going to get much more definitive on a podcast than this, and we've talked it to death.
Well, if we skipped one, there's going to be the person that says, why did you skip that one?
And hey, why didn't you talk about The Man with the Golden Gun? Come on!
I mean, every Bond movie we mentioned is somebody's favorite out there. And you have to respect that. You do. I mean, for a series that's lasted as long as it has and has touched as many generations.
Right.
I mean, from grandfathers to fathers to sons,
mm-hmm,
to future. I mean, your boys are going to enjoy Bond one day.
Yeah, I can't wait for that.
You know, you have to kind of bow down to that and give it its proper space. And,
right,
you know, it's like I was telling you, this isn't the Lethal Weapon show. It's not the Dirty Harry show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this isn't like 5 movies or 6 movies. This is 21 films.
21 films. Or you could say 23 films if you count the two unofficials.
Right. So, I mean, it's nothing to package into a 2-hour format, okay?
Right.
This was the canvas we needed to do the show on, and hopefully you've enjoyed some of the very rare sound clips and music cues that we were able to dig up to layer in.
Absolutely. So I kind of want to look at it this way as we shut it all down and say, okay, who's the best Bond?
Best Bond is Sean Connery.
Sean Connery. We got to say that. But you know what? Here's where you get controversial. Number 2.
Well, right now it's Daniel Craig because he's got the best new Bond movie.
I've got to say Daniel Craig. Now, that's a pretty heavy thing to say after only one film.
Well, he has the best debut film of any Bond.
I mean,
it's better than Dr. No. It's better than Live and Let Die.
Mm-hmm.
It's better than Living Daylights, and it's probably better than GoldenEye.
Yeah.
So that right there is going to give him a lot of cachet and a lot of points.
Isn't that amazing that across the board, all the debut films were very strong?
They are very strong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
except for Lazenby. Forgot about him.
It's probably a little bit too early to tell, but I think if Sean Connery's the best,
mm-hmm,
he's the first Bond to be closer to Sean Connery than any Bond.
Well, he's a brawler. Sean Connery, like I said, is a brawler.
But just even in his look.
Yeah. And his
demeanor,
swagger. Yeah.
And swagger. It's just he'll never be Roger Moore or Pierce Brosnan.
Never.
So it's like now Bonds are in two different style camps.
Yeah.
And now Connery has someone else in his camp. Before, he never did.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was the Moore Brosnan were like on one side of the spectrum. Or maybe it's like you have Connery on one side and you got Moore on the other. You got Brosnan in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
But you got Craig that's more on the Connery side.
Right.
And Lazenby's kind of in between Brosnan, I guess, and Moore,
mm-hmm,
somewhere.
So, all right, best Bond films out of the 21. I mean, what are you going to say? What, like, best 5? What do you think?
Off top of my head, Goldfinger, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
There's that run of Goldfinger, Thunderball, You Only Live Twice.
Right.
That's the Connery run,
definitely,
if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I like the Spy Who Loved Me, For Your Eyes Only, Octopussy run.
Mm-hmm.
From Roger Moore. I like Living Daylights.
Yeah.
And I like GoldenEye.
Yeah.
And I like the new one, Casino Royale.
That's my list. When I knock down my quick list, I'm saying You Only Live Twice as my favorite, GoldenEye, Thunderball, Octopussy, Living Daylights, Live and Let Die. So, okay, so flip that now. What's the worst?
Diamonds Are Forever.
What's at the bottom? Yeah, no doubt.
I think we're both in agreement. It's pretty poor. Diamonds Are Forever, World Is Not Enough.
World Is Not Enough, definitely. A View to a Kill.
Yeah, View to a Kill is right there.
Yeah, License
that,
to Kill.
That might be worse than World Is Not Enough for me.
Nah, I gotta go World Is Not Enough. It's just boring.
It is boring, but again, it's the good moments in it that outweigh the
yeah.
Just, I can't find that many good moments in View to a Kill.
Yeah, it's really bad.
It could be the worst Bond movie, but it probably is Diamonds Are Forever.
Diamonds Are Forever is only the worst because it's so phoned in. It just looks like no one's heart was behind it.
I think one of the underrated Bonds is certainly Octopussy in a lot of ways. A lot of people don't rate that one very high.
Yeah. I like it. Well, you know, Entertainment Weekly has one that came out, and they went ahead and listed the Bonds in what they thought was the best order, and they put Octopussy really low. They put World Is Not Enough at the bottom. At the top, they put Goldfinger, You Only Live Twice, you know, basically the same films that we laid out. So we were pretty normal. The one that was that threw us off there was they put Octopussy really low, and you know, that's my favorite more. So I was surprised with that. And they put Living Daylights really low, which is one that we both liked also.
Yeah, I think both of them have really strong scripts, and they both deliver on the films. I do feel like Aunt Her Majesty's Secret Service is a bit underrated. And I think it's a film that grows.
Yeah.
It's always jarring the first time you see it. Always. Because it's just, it's not right, mm-hmm. is what it is. But when you revisit it, you start seeing the good things in it and appreciate those. And I think it's always going to be the Bond film that could have been. You know, that's unfortunate. My guilty pleasure, I think I said earlier, is probably Moonraker.
Yeah. With me, it's got to be Man with a Golden Gun. Because I'm like the lone guy out there saying, yeah, I kind of like this one. So
now for Bond girls.
Bond girls. Ursula Andress, man.
Ursula Andress. It's hard to go wrong.
Honey Rider. Jane Seymour is Solitaire and Live and Let Die. Famke Janssen is on it up. I mean, she's crazy and she's nuts, but she's sneaking hot, man.
I like Lana Wood. I like Barbara Bach. I really like Lois Childs.
Talisa Soto, Lupe from License to Kill, she's smoking hot. I put her in the top, and you know you can't forget Jill St. John in Diamonds Are Forever.
Right.
I mean, she was very hot for her time, also. So
Eva Green looks really good in the new movie too.
Yeah, absolutely, really pretty.
Yeah.
So there's plenty of them, and you know that's something forever. I think you know the quick thing that people pop to is that scene of Ursula Andress walking on that beach. That's the classic Bond moment. Other than that, people love the Pussy Galore line, but Pussy Galore wasn't as hot as everybody thinks.
Her team was, though.
Yeah, exactly. Her whole team of girls. Yeah, I like the whole team of girls concept. That's pretty, you know, they did that in Octopussy too. I'm like, yeah, I can dig that.
Yeah.
I guess the only other thing to ask would be, you know, what songs did you like? Because that's such a strong part. I would have to put Live and Let Die at the top myself.
Yeah, and just being just a great rocker. You know, Carly Simon's song is really nice and really good.
Goldfinger's the classic song.
I even like Moonraker. I think it's a good song.
Yeah.
I like View to a Kill. I think it's a good funky poppy song.
No. World Is Not Enough by Garbage. Absolutely great.
I like that. Yeah.
The only one that I out and out really don't like is All Time High.
Okay.
Now, that
I like the music in it.
I like the music in the score. But that was that from Octopussy?
It was Octopussy. It's Rita Coolidge.
Yeah, that's the one that just doesn't work for me in the opening sequence.
Yeah.
But it just bugs me. But that's really the only one. I mean, all the rest are really nice. I even kind of like the License to Kill song. I think the hook is really nice in it.
Yeah.
The rest of the song, like you were saying, is kind of weak. But I think that's really interesting. That's what people always talk about. You know, what's your favorite Bond girl? What's your favorite song? There's so many things to look at. But, you know, going across and looking at films, I got to tell you, my experience over the last 21 films has been a blast. I was not a Bond fan going in, and I'm converted now. And I've had a great time. And I want to thank you for hooking me up with all these movies. And you've been preaching to me for a long time. Hey, you need to see Honor Majesty's Secret Service. Hey, you need to check this out. You need to go do this stuff. And you know what? You were damn right. I'm a fan. They really came through for us with Casino Royale. And so it's nothing but good, you know? I mean, this is a great experience, and we definitely want to thank you guys for hanging out with us.
Definitely, and I think if this proves anything is not only that you can't write Bond out, he's never out.
Right.
You know, I mean, I even love, like, the naysayers like Jeffrey Wells that have been trying to trash Bond for the last year and have to eat crow now.
Yeah.
because Bond has been reinvented and reinvented well.
Right.
But, you know, it's been a long ride. What, 40 years or so?
Yeah, well, 62. So,
I mean,
yeah, more than 40 years. That's amazing.
There's not another franchise that can really claim that kind of... I mean, that's going to have to go into the Guinness Book also, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, there's nothing else.
Yeah.
There's no other series. I mean, you know, you've got your films that are a trilogy, or, you know, Star Wars has got six, you know, but come on.
And I feel confident that Craig is not going to be the last Bond either.
No.
I think he's the right Bond to keep it alive for this decade.
Mm-hmm.
And sometime, I imagine, around 2012 to 2015... we'll be looking at the future of Bond once again. But until then, I'm just going to strap on my seatbelt and hang on, because I think the reboot works, and we're ready.
All right, I'm going to wrap up this episode of the Hollywood Saloon, the Bond Never Dies series, finally coming to a close. I wanted to bring a couple things to your attention that some of our listeners keyed us in on. We made a couple of errors in Bond number 2, and I want to go ahead and set the record straight on those. I actually said that Roger Moore was 36 when he took on the role of James Bond in 1973's Live and Let Die. He was actually 45 at the time of release of Live and Let Die, which makes him the oldest Bond as he entered into the series. So I apologize for that error, but yeah, it's a decade is a big difference. In comparison, if you look at it, Sean Connery was only 32 when he started as James Bond. George Lazenby was 30, so he was the youngest. And then Timothy Dalton at 43, Pierce Brosnan at 42, and Daniel Craig at 38. Another thing that we wrongly said was that Casino Royale, which was released in 2006, was the first Bond film to be released on an even number year since 1974's Man with the Golden Gun. And in fact, that is not true. It was actually Die Another Day, which was released in 2002. So there you go, another little factual mistake we made there, but hopefully we cleared those things up. I wanted to give you some numbers for Casino Royale, because back when we recorded our section on it, when it was first released, we didn't know how successful it would be. In the end, it ended up having a total box office revenue of $594,293,106, which is pretty impressive in the field of things. I think just gross dollars, it's the biggest Bond film ever. But, you know, when you adjust them, it becomes a different story. Now, normally what we did on the show was we put the Bond movies in order by the number of admissions that they had to give it a sort of fair playing field. Well, the source that I got those from has changed their list now, and they no longer list admissions, but they list adjusted dollar values. So if we put that into the mix and we look at it, now this is, like I said, on a different playing scale than what we've done every other Bond movie in the series on as we looked at them, so just take that with a grain of salt. But if you look at them adjusted for inflation, Casino Royale ends up at number 7. So that's pretty dang good. The rest of the list would look like this. Number 1, Thunderball, as we stated before. Number 2, Goldfinger. Number 3, Live and Let Die. Number 4, You Only Live Twice. Number 5, The Spy Who Loved Me. Number 6, Moonraker. Then number 7, Casino Royale. And then finishing out the top 10, Diamonds Are Forever at number 8. Number 9, Die Another Day. And number 10, From Russia with Love. And all of those with a adjusted dollar value of over $500 million. Last thing I wanted to mention about Bond is that after we had already recorded all this and the new Casino Royale was just such a resounding success, they immediately went to announce the new films. And right now you can expect Bond number 22, which we don't have a title for yet at this time, definitely will be out next year, 2008, probably in November, possibly if they can get it done to May. I don't see that happening because they haven't started shooting yet, but you're going to look at it toward Christmas time. It was officially announced that Mark Foster will direct, and you've seen him before with Finding Neverland, Stranger Than Fiction, and Monsters Ball. Writers Robert Wade, Neil Purvis, and Paul Haggis are back. And, of course, Daniel Craig is back, thank God. And strange enough, they've already gone ahead and announced Bond 23 for a 2010 release. So they're already squatting on that spot. And I don't know if it's going to be a summer release or a Christmas-type holiday release, but you know, they're moving forward. Every 2 years now, we're talking Bond movies, and that's just nothing but a good thing. So Bond continues. It's totally exciting. If John and I are still here doing this, we will cover them as fully as we've done on these last three shows. But anyways, thanks, guys, for listening to the Bond series. We want to invite you over to our website at www.hollywoodsaloon.com. You can write us an email at hollywoodsaloon@yahoo.com. And I want to tell you that the best way to stay in the know about the Hollywood Saloon, to discuss all this stuff, to hear the latest news and info, is to be a part of our forums. And you can get there by coming to our main page. On the left-hand side, you see the links, and it just says discussion group or discussion forum. And come on over, sign up, and get in on that, because that's where you find out what's going on. And we will definitely be discussing Bond with the release of Bond 3. So anyways, that's it, guys. Thanks for hanging in. Thanks for your patience. And we will see you next time.
You're listening to the Hollywood Saloon.